Donald Trump tightens the economic noose on Rocket Man, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The president announces yet tougher sanctions on North Korea. He says everyone's on board. But are they? South Korea is again sending humanitarian aid to the North.
North Koreans, no matter how many missiles they shoot, no matter how many threats they make, they're still Koreans. They're starving, and they need our help.
Also today, as Hurricane Maria continues to batter the Caribbean, we flash back to 1988 and another hurricane, one that brought a plague of locusts.
There were just so many insects flying all over the place and landing on buildings, on cars, on people.
Plus, we get to meet the original M. butterfly. Those stories coming up today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. On our radar today, Donald Trump and Africa, a key election in the heart of Europe, sharks, and even locusts. But let's start with Korea. The conflict over North Korea's escalating nuclear weapons program ratcheted up another notch today as President Trump announced new sanctions against the country. Trump also praised China's central bank for ordering financial institutions there to stop doing business with North Korea. But amid the growing tensions, there are also occasional gestures of goodwill on the Korean peninsula. South Korea today said it was reinstating direct humanitarian aid to the North that had been cut off last year. I got the latest from reporter Jason Strother in Seoul.
The United Nations World Food Program has been pressing South Korea since the spring to resume its humanitarian assistance to North Korea. So today, the government here announced that it is going to spend $8 million to provide nutritional and medical supplies to North Korea via the UN through UNICEF and the World Food Program. So it's not direct aid, but it is something.
What's been the reaction from South Koreans about this news?
President Moon Jae-in's popularity has been on the decline over the past few weeks. A fairly reliable local polling agency put out a survey earlier this week that showed, you know, while still at 67% approval, it is down from week on end. And some of that, according to the pollster, has to do with his North Korea policy.
It seems clear that South Korean President Moon Jae-in and President Trump really disagree on how to deal with North Korea. What's the crux of their disagreement?
President Moon Jae-in has hope that this situation can be resolved through dialogue, through negotiations. But by all means, Seoul has not been dovish during the past several months. They have supported the sanctions at the UN Security Council. But nonetheless, when Moon was elected back in May, a part of his platform was to improve ties with Pyongyang via dialogue. Now, those overtures that Seoul has made to North Korea have come up with nothing so far. But I don't think that President Moon is giving up. And even if it's a small gesture, such as $8 million worth of humanitarian assistance, perhaps this is Seoul's way of still, you know, keeping the door open to talks.
Is the notion behind this aid package purely humanitarian, or is there some part of Moon Jae-in that thinks that by making that overture, he's giving something and trying to ease tension?
While North Korea has not been in a state of famine for many years, there is still severe malnutrition, a severe food shortage up in the north. So South Korea wants the help. But, you know, Moon Jae-in, he comes from a generation and also of a political persuasion where North Korea, you know, they're kind of South Korea's wayward brothers that, you know, perhaps they've gone wrong, but they're still Korean. When Moon got into politics in the early 2000s, when he was a part of previous liberal administrations, they gave a lot of assistance to North Korea, food aid, fertilizer, medicine, you name it. So perhaps that is still an instinct that North Koreans, no matter how many missiles they shoot, no matter how many threats they make, they're still Koreans, they're starving, and they need our help.
Jason, I'm really curious about how South Koreans responded to Trump's really bellicose speech at the UN, calling Kim Jong-un Rocket Man and talking about destroying North Korea if he has to. How did that go down with South Koreans?
I think South Koreans are still trying to determine if Donald Trump is really serious about launching a preemptive attack against North Korea and kind of changing the status quo here on the peninsula. You have to remember, South Koreans are completely unfazed and have been so for many years about whatever North Korea says, whether it's turning Seoul into a sea of fire or starting a nuclear holocaust. South Koreans, they go about their daily lives untouched. But this certainly is a different scenario here with Trump going, you know, toe-to-toe with Kim Jong-un in terms of rhetoric. And I don't think South Koreans really know what to make of it yet.
Correspondent Jason Strother is based in Seoul, South Korea. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks a lot, Carol.
When President Trump introduced himself to African leaders at the UN in New York yesterday, some of those gathered were taken aback by his welcome.
I'm greatly honored to host this lunch, to be joined by the leaders of Cote d'Ivoire, Ethiopia, Ghana, Guinea, Namibia.
Yes, you heard him say it, Namibia. No, the country doesn't exist, although Gambia, Zambia, and Namibia do. A stumble, perhaps, then it popped up again.
In Guinea and Nigeria, you fought a horrifying Ebola outbreak. Namibia's health system is increasingly self-sufficient.
It was another one of those Trump moments. We reached out to Chude Jidowa, a lawyer and journalist based in Lagos, Nigeria. Chude, how did that sound to you?
I mean, I guess I'd be surprised if he knew how to pronounce it, to be honest. He's not had much facility with international relations in places where he's not run his businesses.
To be fair, a White House pool report clarified that the president did indeed mean Namibia. Still, how did the gaffe play with your friends and colleagues?
It fits a trend that makes him some sort of global laughingstock, especially in Africa. He has a lot to say, but much of what he says isn't necessarily informed, isn't necessarily well thought out, isn't necessarily knowledgeable. And so it's been cause for laughter across the continent.
What have you been seeing on social media in response to it?
All kinds of. I mean, social media has been killing me. People are tweeting him pictures from the actual country of Namibia, things that are happening there, pictures of villages, pictures of skyscrapers, pictures of electricity. But I think that Namibia deserves to be talked about globally. It's a relatively stable country. Its healthcare is functional. Its environmental protection is written into its constitution. And this is a country that got independence last. So I think by error, Trump has done a good deed.
I want to play another clip from that luncheon that's perhaps more revealing.
Africa has tremendous business potential. I have so many friends going to your countries trying to get rich. I congratulate you. They're spending a lot of money.
How did you like that characterization of Africa?
That one was the real tragedy. So here's the thing. This is a president that sees himself as charming, that sees himself as good at branding, that sees himself as capable of working a room. It's tone deaf to talk about your business friends coming to extract resources from a continent that is barely recovering from the exploitation of people from the north over the past 100 to 150 years.
Trump hasn't made a lot of references to Africa since he's become president. He's left key Africa positions at the State Department vacant. And when he has called African leaders on the phone, it's tended to be to discuss terrorism. How does that strike you?
He doesn't seem to understand the complexity of the nations. For a president who loves strong men, he doesn't appreciate the beauty of a man like Macky Sall from Senegal, who willingly reduce his constitutionally allowed term limits to strengthen democracy in his country. He is ignorant about the complexities of the African continent. He's ignorant about the potential of African people. He's ignorant about how many young Africans are driving the academia, the economy, Silicon Valley, Facebook, all of that in his own country.
Trump isn't the first American president to make gaffes when it comes to Africa, mispronounce things, not know where things are. What distinguishes his particular malaprops and comments?
Many of us who are on social media are millennials. I'm a millennial. We've had a Barack Obama for 8 years. He was born in Hawaii. He grew up in Indonesia. He visited Kenya before he was president. He'd seen the world. He'd studied the world's issues with the seriousness that they deserve. And so we have not been used over the past 8 to 10 years to this amount of willing ignorance. That's the difference.
Chude Jidowo, a lawyer and journalist based in Lagos, Nigeria. He's currently a fellow at Yale. Thanks so much, Chude.
Thank you for having me.
Imagine not being able to go home because of something you wrote. That's the reality today for our next guest. Jamal Khashoggi is a journalist who lives in Washington, D.C., but his home is in Saudi Arabia. He wrote an opinion piece in the Washington Post this week. He spoke about mass arrests of independent journalists and intellectuals, about the Saudi government, quote, bashing journalists on social media if they were critical of government policies. And those words could make it difficult for him to go home anytime soon. Mr. Khashoggi, the title of your article was Saudi Arabia Wasn't Always This Repressive. Now it's unbearable. What prompted you to write it?
A number of things. Arrest, mass arrest, which we never witnessed before. A campaign, an intimidation against writers, intellectuals. That prompted me to say something because this is not the direction I was hoping my country to take, particularly with the rise to power of Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
You mentioned Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He's young. He's just 31. He's now next in line to lead the country. And you were positive about him. What are your mixed feelings about him now?
It's just this intolerance that is totally unneeded. He doesn't have opposition. People are willing to support his reform plans. And these reform plans are going to be painful because they're going to address economic matters, unemployment, and that requires unity, not division. But what we have right now is division. Saudis targeting other Saudis. Saudis hating other Saudis.
And do you think Prince Mohammed bin Salman is behind that divisiveness?
Look, he's in charge. It is not him who's spying. He's not him who's intimidating. But this is happening under his watch. And I urge him to stop it. He needs to stop that.
Who has been affected by this?
There are more than 30 or 40 Saudis who were jailed for being critique of government policies. Many of them I know personally are friends.
We've seen the prince lately in photo ops with President Trump here in the U.S. and in Saudi Arabia. What's your assessment of how the prince will steer his country's relations with the U.S.?
He has the total support of the American administration. This is good. It is healthy for Saudi Arabia. It will help him guide Saudi Arabia into reform. But in the same time, I wish the administration will remind the leadership in Saudi Arabia of tolerance and oppression, that it is not healthy. It will not help his reform. And as I said earlier, this reform is going to be painful, and it requires unity of the people around the prince.
I want to go back to your situation. Will you be able to go home to Saudi Arabia?
No. In principle, I can, but of course, I will risk being arrested or being banned from travel, and that will be very suffocating. And actually, last week, a friend of mine whom I met in Washington and an independent Saudi, I wrote about him in my article, Isam al-Zamil, and he flew back to Saudi Arabia where he was arrested. If Isam, who is very independent, who is not linked to any political organization, is arrested, I'm sure I'm going to be arrested as well.
You end your Washington Post article by admitting that you'd kept silent when friends were arrested. You were afraid of losing your job or endangering your family. Why did you make a different choice this week?
Because I'm free here, and I will feel very much bad, very much guilty, if I continue in enjoying my life, being silent when I can speak.
Journalist Jamal Khashoggi is from Saudi Arabia. He lives and works in Washington, D.C. He spoke to us from New York. Thanks so much, Jamal.
Thank you very much.
Support for this podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. Some of the most important questions facing the world today intersect with the global capital markets. Climate change, autonomous driving, the future of China's economic growth. On Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast, you'll hear discussions on topics with far-reaching implications like these, plus much more. Think of it as a place to get insights from some of the world's leading thinkers on markets, industries, and the global economy. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. Sachs, available on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I like words.
A podcast.
Crunchy, crackly words.
About language.
Trixie, Tucker, Gentile.
The world in words.
Oh, heavens, my gracious landsake words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. As if the rains and winds of hurricanes and tropical storms weren't bad enough by themselves, it's worth remembering what else they can sometimes bring. Like in 1988, when Hurricane Joan churned through the Caribbean and brought with it, I'm not kidding, a plague of locusts all the way from Africa, more than 3,000 miles away. Claire Bowes of the BBC program Witness has this look back at that bizarre event, beginning with a news report from the fall of 1988.
A huge plague of locusts, the worst for 30 years, is sweeping across North and West Africa. Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia and Libya are the places worst hit so far, but scientists say the plague could spread to other countries.
A plague of locusts, something feared by people for thousands of years. And despite the march of technology, even 20th century chemicals were not enough to combat the sheer volume and speed of a successful swarm. During the summer of 1988, fear was building that the desert locusts would spread further south in Africa, causing widespread famine. But what happened next was completely unprecedented, leaving the experts baffled.
And in fact, over the last few days, we may have seen what is really a very remarkable event in that many locusts have been blown out into the Atlantic, and we've now had confirmed reports of swarms reaching the West Indies.
The United Nations warned this week that a locust plague that has been devastating Africa for over 2 years is now spreading beyond that continent. Travelling west, millions of locusts landed in the Caribbean this week after making an unprecedented flight across the Atlantic. It's a journey the experts had thought was impossible and means the locusts were flying continuously for 5 days. How they did it is still a mystery.
I believe it was the morning of October the 17th, 1988, that I got to work, and then we heard reports that loads of locusts and grasshoppers were landing on the east coast. And it's believed that they were associated at the time with a storm called Tropical Storm Joan.
Central America is on red alert this afternoon as the latest hurricane to hit the Caribbean rages out at sea. Hurricane Joan has already caused...
On St. Lucia, most people had never seen locusts before, let alone in such huge numbers.
There were just so many insects flying all over the place and landing on buildings, on cars, on people.
Guy Mathurin was the island's only insect expert. He worked as an entomologist and plant protection officer at the Ministry of Agriculture.
Some people were kind of scared of them, you know, because they do have big mandibles which they use to eat grass and plant material with. So some people were afraid they might get bitten.
The locust looks just like a grasshopper. The difference is in its behaviour. Both eat voraciously, but locusts are sociable creatures, and when crowded together, they swarm. As immature adults, they hop along in unison, but once strong enough, they develop wings and really take off, eating their own weight in food every day and then flying en masse to the next meal.
We didn't know how they would react, whether they would eat all the bananas, whether they'd eat all the mango trees, the coconut trees, and, you know. But the main concern for us at the time was, would they make St. Lucia their home? And would they become a troublesome pest and eat everything green in sight?
Millions of others had landed across the Caribbean. The bright white sandy beaches of Barbados, Trinidad and Jamaica were said to be littered with them. Some dead, some dying, while others made their way inland.
And very soon, they were flying all over the island. They weren't in a big swarm which would darken the sky, but they were flying all over the place.
But on St. Lucia, after a few days, Guy Mathurin realised the locusts were not doing well.
they seem to be disoriented. It could have been because of the energy they expended in that long trip over the Atlantic. And probably it was a bit too humid in the Caribbean for them, you know. Anyway, it was a bit difficult to judge exactly what was going on. But one interesting thing that we noted was that they did not seem to be feeding.
It's still unclear how these insects, which need to eat every 24 hours, had survived a five-day journey across the Atlantic. One theory is that they ate each other, with some falling down onto the sea, forming a mat of dead insects, which the others could then feed on. The ones that did reach land died off pretty quickly, having spurned the island's fruit trees. But a few weeks later, Guy got a call from the captain of a supertanker off the coast of St. Lucia.
I believe it was Monday the 7th of November that year. We did get a report that one of those huge supertankers had encountered a swarm of locusts about 900 miles out in the Atlantic. And the captain described the swarm as being so thick that the whole deck of the tanker was covered in pink. Although the majority of the swarm on the tanker was pink in color, which indicated immature adults, we did find one or two yellowish colored locusts, which would indicate that they were just getting into sexual maturity.
And that's much more worrying.
Well, yes, because at that stage they would start to mate and then they would look for places to lay eggs. And if they laid eggs, that means that's one stage of becoming established in the country. And then when we got there, some of the swarm had left. And then as soon as the pest control guys started spraying operations, the rest of the swarm just took off in the direction of the wind. Because they are gregarious animals, as long as a couple start taking off, the whole swarm tends to follow. And they all just took off, like, over maybe, let's say, about 4 or 5 minutes. They just started taking off and flying away.
That was the last Guy Mathurin saw of the desert locusts, and they never did get established in the Caribbean. But their visit left a lasting impression on him.
Yeah, I mean, I respect most creatures. More or less, I love the job I do. I was always interested in the biological world and seeing the phenomena of a swarm of locusts, which we've only read about in the Bible and read about as an agricultural pests in Africa. It was a real big thing for me as a professional to see the swarm in action.
Entomologist Guy Mathurin from the Caribbean island of St. Lucia, looking back at the locust swarm of 1988, ending our report from the BBC's Claire Bowes.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
It's a brown president looking into the eyes of brown people, saying that I acknowledge what our government has done.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills. Alison Koch grew up in South Africa, and at an early age, she fell in love with sharks.
My dad said to me, Alison, they'll be fine. Just pick them up, kiss them on the nose, and release them back into the water.
Now she's helping other girls get into shark research. That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. It's a big weekend coming up in Germany. That's where voters head to the polls to decide whether Chancellor Angela Merkel will serve a fourth term. They could also send a far-right populist party to Parliament. The World's Daniel Gross has been reporting from Berlin.
This has been described as a quiet election in Germany, and that's mostly true from what I've been seeing. One of the reasons the election has been so quiet is that the two leading parties agree on a lot of things. And these two parties are the CDU, the Christian Democratic Union, the party of Angela Merkel, and the SPD, the Social Democratic Party, led by Martin Schulz. And when Merkel and Schulz faced off in a debate not too long ago, it was so good-natured that it was described as a duet rather than a duel. These are two candidates that really don't disagree on all that much. It's pretty much a foregone conclusion, at least my sources are telling me, that Angela Merkel is going to win, and the two parties are likely to work together in a coalition. And so this is definitely not an epic showdown. At the same time, there are Germans that I've been speaking to that say this could be quite a significant election for Germany and for Europe.
If it's kind of ho-hum over there, what's at stake for Germany and for the EU in this election?
Well, so because those first two places are seem sort of predetermined, this has really become a battle for the bronze medal, as one of my sources said. It's a battle for third place. And the significance of third place here is that third place will very likely be the leader of the opposition. So this will be an opposition party that is pushing back against the parties that lead. And so the party that seems likely to win that third place position is the AfD, which is the Alternative for Deutschland. And that's the far right party that many of the mainstream parties are pretty worried about.
Daniel, who's attracted to this right-wing party, the AfD? What sort of Germans is it appealing to?
So from my reading, I've been hearing that the AfD is pulling voters from other parties, from a wide range of parties, and they're doing better among lower-income Germans and slightly less educated Germans. But that's not the sole characteristic. It seems to be gathering a lot of voters who are disillusioned with other parties, who don't feel that the existing mainstream parties represent them.
What are German voters and politicians saying about this prospect of having a right-wing party as an influential party in the parliament?
Well, I spoke to one MP this morning. His name is Konstantin von Notz, and he's a Green Party member of parliament. He feels that this could actually be a historic break from the German tradition of politics, which has tended to be, by American standards, left, and it's tended to really shy away from far-right parties.
I think you see that there is a threat to democracy, and we probably have to deal with that from Sunday on.
Sunday, of course, is the date of the election, and von Notz is saying here that he's very aware of German history. He hearkened back to this German democracy that came before the Nazis.
You're talking about the Weimar Republic.
Exactly, the weak democracy that crumbled when the Nazis rose to power. Normally, it's kind of a taboo to compare a German politician to the Nazi party, but von Notz says that this time around it's different. That comparison has been fairly common in German politics.
How does Mr. von Notz think the rise of the AfD in Germany, this right-wing party, fits within other right-wing populist movements we're seeing in Europe and elsewhere?
He did say, you know, there's some similarity between the rise of Donald Trump, who's also a populist, and the success of Brexit, which took a lot of people by surprise, and the rise of the AfD. And one thing that von Notz talked about is trying to learn lessons from those events. He said that he's paying more attention to the fear and the anger that some voters feel, including the fear that jobs are disappearing and that immigration is going to change German culture.
The World's Daniel Gross speaking to us from Berlin. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Migration is a big issue in Germany, as it is across much of Europe. But something unexpected has happened in the region's migrant crisis over the last year. In August 2016, an estimated 21,000 migrants reached Italy from Libya. This past August, that number was down to just 4,000, a drop of more than three quarters. So what's changed? My BBC colleague Benjamin Zand has been exploring how the migrant route is changing in a new documentary called Africa's Billion-Pound Migrant Trail. Ben, why are fewer migrants getting through?
For a number of reasons, really. I mean, one of the major changes is as a consequence of investment from the EU in the Libyan Coast Guard. They have trained over 130 people. They've given boats to the Libyan Coast Guard. What the EU want now is to essentially people to be stopped in Libyan waters and sent back to Libya. And it seems at the moment to be working, but we can't say categorically it will forever be working. But it is for now, it seems.
Now, you were able to ride along with the Libyan Coast Guard as they chased migrants and intercepted the migrant boats. What was that like?
Massively depressing. I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, the sheer number of people that we came across in the space of about 6 hours was absolutely incredible. We stopped four boats, each with about 150 people in them. This is men, women and children. The Coast Guard were armed with an RPG and machine guns. So it gives you a sense of the kind of seas there. We were told by the Coast Guard leader at the time that the week previously they had lost some men as a consequence of a shootout with smugglers. So it is not a safe place for anybody to be. And when you're seeing that many numbers of people going across the sea in boats that look like they're made from crates, it's depressing.
It's just incredible scenes in your documentary. Ben, remind us just how huge the migrant smuggling business is. I mean, your own documentary is named Africa's Billion Pound Migrant Trail, which is basically the same as $1 billion.
Yeah, I mean, to give you a sense of how much some of these people are earning, you know, I went to Nigeria because this is one of the main source countries. And, you know, speaking to some of the girls who quite often end up working in prostitution in Europe, the numbers that they're citing that they owe to smugglers are, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 that they have to pay to a smuggler. And just the sheer number of people, you know, so far this year, about 100,000 people have made it to Italy via the Libyan route. And you can work out the maths yourself, but that is an incredible amount of money. And it's not really hard to see why smugglers do it.
Are these young women people who have to get that money before they make the crossing?
No, so they don't. I mean, that is essentially where it gets quite dark. So it's a bond that they owe to a smuggler. So a woman in Nigeria will agree a fee of, say, $50,000. And then the smuggler will loan them some money for the trip. But that means when they get to Italy, usually they go and then work with a madame who owns what is essentially a brothel. And they are stuck in the prostitution trade for years and years and years, all to repay this money. So for example, say if they get 20 euros, which is about $20, $22 per each individual client they service, they are going to have to work. They're going to have sex with about five people a day for about 3 years just to pay back the money they owe, which gives you a sense of how horrible this is for these people.
So they're forced into essentially sex slavery once they arrived.
Yeah, I mean, and what was quite difficult for me is, you know, I was in Nigeria and I spoke to two girls and I said to them straight up, you know, what are you going to do when you get to Europe? I've heard some people enter the sex trade and they said categorically, yes, we will enter the sex trade. We will do whatever it takes to get money. And it gives you a sense of the desperation of some of these people. You know, Europe, you know, there is a real European dream in the mentality of quite a lot of people going along the migrant trail. They assume that everything is better in Europe. And if sex is one way to make money, it's, you know, at least it's better than the life they have, which sadly I don't think is true because some of the stories I've heard of people who have made it are horrible. But it's also the smugglers who feed into these lies. You know, they tell people that from the shores of Libya, you can see Italy. They tell people that it's a 20-minute ferry ride across the Mediterranean. They tell people you can get across the Sahara in a couple of hours. And it's all a complete lie. And they neglect to tell them how many people die along the way and how bad it is and how many people are raped and how many people are locked up. And it's a kind of mix of misinformation, naivety and desperation that leads people to make this journey. And it is truly upsetting.
The BBC's Benjamin Zand, who has a new documentary out called Africa's Billion Pound Migrant Trail. Thanks so much, Ben.
No problem. Thanks.
You've probably heard of the Puccini opera, Madame Butterfly, but not everyone is familiar with the play M. Butterfly. It's about a French diplomat in Beijing who falls in love with a Chinese opera singer. She turns out to be a spy, and then she turns out to be a man. It's all based on a true story. Broadway is mounting the revival of M. Butterfly this fall, but so is a smaller theater in Baltimore. And the director of that show got the chance to meet the French diplomat who inspired the story. Here's reporter Jake Saganero.
Director Vincent Lanchisi and his wife were traveling in the south of France earlier this year. They were chatting with their driver, and he told them a story about his former employer.
He said, well, I was a driver for a very famous man. You probably don't know his name, but there's a movie about him made with Jeremy Irons called M. Butterfly.
Mademoiselle Soon. It was a beautiful performance.
Thank you.
I've always seen opera singers as overweight ladies in too much bad makeup.
My wife looked at me, her jaw dropped. I said, what?
Lanchisi was already scheduled to direct M. Butterfly by David Henry Wong this fall at Everyman Theater in Baltimore. When Lanchisi told his driver about it, the man put him in touch with his old boss, Bernard Boursicault, one of the central figures in the M. Butterfly story.
And, you know, from the moment I had Bernard Boursicault on the phone, I just said, I can't imagine what it must be like to live a life where the vast majority of the world has passed judgment on you based on a work of fiction about your life.
This summer, Lanchisi returned to France with his lead actor, Bruce Wilson, to meet Boursicault.
Bonjour.
Boursicault greets them with a kiss on the cheek.
How are you? Welcome.
He's 83 now and lives in a retirement home in a small town in Brittany. Back in the 1960s, Boursicault was a 20-year-old accountant at the French embassy in Beijing. He met an opera singer named Xu Pei Pu at a Christmas party, a male opera singer. They became friends, and Xu Pei Pu invited Boursicault to his house one evening.
He started to explain me a story that it was traditional in China, that there was a guy... No, it was a girl who became to look like a guy and to behave like a guy.
It was a Chinese tale of a woman who lived as a man for her family's sake. Xu Pei Pu told Boursicault that this was his story too. He lied and told Boursicault that he was actually a woman forced to live as a man because boys were more valued in China. Boursicault wrote about this in his journal.
On my journal, I wrote revelation, revealed. Mm-hmm. So everything in my head changed. Yeah. And a few days after, it was July, mm-hmm. and we had sex for the first time. And he provided blood.
So how is it possible Boursicault did not know he was having sex with a man? Xu Pei Pu would later show doctors in a medical exam how he could create the illusion that he was female. And Boursicault says their intimate moments were always in the dark. Perhaps he was naive, or he just found the lie more exciting than the truth. But that's not the end of it.
Short time after, he explained me that he was pregnant. He made me believe that he was pregnant.
By this time, Boursicault, the embassy employee, had already begun passing French documents to the Chinese government to help Xu Pei Pu climb the Communist Party ranks. Boursicault eventually left Beijing for another post. When he returned for a visit, Xu Pei Pu had bought a child and passed him off as their son. Later, Boursicault brought Xu Pei Pu to Paris, though the relationship didn't last. And in 1983, they were arrested in France on charges of espionage. To this day, Boursicault claims he didn't know his lover was a man until it was revealed in court.
And I told him, why didn't you tell me you were a man? Told me we had no time. We never had time.
Death with honor is better than life with this one.
Spoiler alert. In M. Butterfly, the fictional French diplomat dies. Boursicault once saw Anthony Hopkins perform the role in London.
It was funny because there were people who were crying behind me and I wanted to say, don't cry so much, I am still alive.
Boursicault seems to get a kick out of the fame and attention, though he says he doesn't like the way the M. Butterfly narrative has taken over his story. After all the interviews he gave years ago, I ask him why he keeps agreeing to do more.
Because I don't want to keep only a story which is not exact. Maybe people know me, it's better, I think.
After Lanchisi and Wilson say goodbye, they try to reconcile M. Butterfly's fictional protagonist with the man they just met. But even after 5 hours with Boursicault, Lanchisi says he still has a lot of questions. And that's okay.
I feel like there's even more mystery now about the man than there was before I met him, which is fabulous because it only enforces what the play already puts out there.
For The World, Jake Zaganero, Livret-sur-Changeant, France.
You've no doubt heard about Shark Week, that crazy annual cable TV extravaganza. Well, this week is Shark Week of a whole other kind here in Boston. The venue is the New England Aquarium, and it's where 10 women from around the world came this week with one goal: getting more women into shark research. The traditionally male-dominated field is changing, and these top shark researchers want to inspire the next generation. Allison Koch is a researcher in South Africa, and Cynthia Wagren is the CEO of the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy and directs the Gills Club, which promotes STEM education for girls. Let's start with you, Allison. Why sharks? How did you get started in shark research?
I was really fortunate to have a father that was passionate about the ocean, and he took me fishing from when I was a little girl, and we would catch lobster in these nets, and we have these sharks called shy sharks. They're about 3 feet long, and I was really concerned about these sharks coming up in the crayfish nets, and my dad said to me, "Allison, they'll be fine, just pick them up, kiss them on the nose, and release them back into the water." And so that's how I got interested in sharks and the ocean, and he fostered that passion for the ocean from a very early age.
How about you, Cynthia? How did you get interested?
I actually got interested when I did a trip to South Africa and went cage diving with white sharks. So for me personally, I've been fascinated by wildlife and had a passion for all kinds of wildlife, but it was that experience, cage diving with great white sharks, that really piqued my interest.
Cynthia, you're very interested in educating girls about sharks. Why are sharks interesting, and why should anyone be interested in them?
Well, sharks are interesting for many, many reasons. I think people are fascinated with sharks because of their power and their speed. And really, for me, that first moment of being underwater with a shark and just watching its movement, its grace, they're just these amazing animals. And they're, I think, too many things to name about them. But what we have found that's really fascinating is that there are a lot of young girls that we've met who have an immediate interest in them and connection. And so I think it's really incredible to see that passion start early and continue.
Is part of your interest in getting away from the kind of maleness and the macho-ness of people who deal with sharks in a stereotypical way?
What we found was that some of these girls that we were meeting who were interested in sharks at an early age were being told at school by other kids that sharks were just for boys. If you look at Shark Week, and that's a place where a lot of kids get their information about sharks, you don't see a lot of females highlighted. These girls, if they're watching Shark Week and they're not seeing female scientists, and then they're being told at school that sharks are just for boys, they're being discouraged from following their passion. So for us, connecting them to these female shark scientists doing amazing work was really important. Another part of that is just showing them through shark research how math is used and engineering is used. And you see that these girls look at it in a very different way than they would normally at school. So we utilize that enthusiasm and interest in sharks to keep them also connected to STEM subjects.
There's so much information that we've learned in the last few years. On so many levels, it's just incredibly exciting. And to be able to share that with girls at the symposium, we had girls of 5 years old doing dissections, and they got stuck in there. I was so impressed with them.
These are 5-year-old girls dissecting a shark?
Yes. We had high school girls asking the most phenomenal questions. And for me, it was fantastic to see the diversity of these women and what they're doing. It's just been a fantastic experience.
Allison, how has the field changed for women since you started?
It's changed a lot. So I started 20 years ago now, and I was the only woman on a research boat. And I was very fortunate to have fantastic male role models, but I've heard of a lot of stories where women don't have that. And there's been a major change. And in fact, a lot of the research labs that are focusing on sharks have a large diversity of people, including women now, which wasn't the case 10, 20 years ago. And I think that women have really found a niche in this particular field and have excelled in it. And yet you still don't have a lot of platforms where their work is being showcased.
Cynthia, have you seen the attitude towards shark conservation change? Are people getting more aware that this is an important species that we need to protect? And are governments getting involved at all?
We have definitely seen a shift in public perception of the shark since starting the organization 5 years ago. At the time, especially on Cape Cod, it's a tourist economy, and there was a lot of fear about sharks being in the water. Since that time in the Conservancy, a big piece of what we do is to educate the community. And the way that we do that is by supporting the science. We won't know anything about these animals unless we have scientists out there studying them. I think the more you know, the less you fear. And so really replacing those fears with fact-based information has seemed to shift the community's thought about having white sharks right off of our coast from one of fear to one of fascination. Anytime I'm on the beach, people around me are talking about the sharks and hoping to see a shark fin. Obviously, you'd want to be on the beach and not in the water when that happens. But we've had sharks that have stranded on the beaches. And in two cases, everybody on the beach rallied around to help save those sharks. And in one case, I had a full beach full of people dragging that shark back into the water, a 14-foot great white shark that, you know, years ago, that shark would have been killed. And we were really excited to see people stand up and say, no, it's the shark's habitat. You know, this is their world. They're important to have here. I absolutely have seen a shift.
I got to go to my curiosity question as we're speaking here. I'm swimming, say, in the Atlantic near the Cape, and I come upon a shark. What should I do?
Well, the first thing is if you do see the shark, you're really in a good position because these are ambushed predators. It's the shark you don't see, which is the problem. So if you do see the shark, I know it's really hard advice to follow and it's hard to imagine, but you need to stay calm. You need to keep your eye on the shark. A lot of times we know that when sharks, like any other kind of ambushed predator, know that they've been seen, they kind of give up the game already. So for the most part, you have to stay calm and then try and get out of the water as quickly as possible. The moment you panic, you're going to attract attention. You might attract that instinct that the shark has to chase you. In the extremely unlikely event the shark comes in and tries to bite you, then you can last-ditch event to try and punch it in the gills, which is a very sensitive area. But it's extremely unlikely that most of us will ever experience that.
Alison Koch is a shark researcher from South Africa, and Cynthia Wagren runs the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, along with the Gills Club, which promotes STEM education for girls. We've got photos of both Koch and Wagren at work with sharks. They're over at PRI.org. And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.